Are you struggling to relax? Are you finding it hard to get a good night's sleep after leaving a narcissistic abusive relationship? Hi, I'm Dr. Carrie Kerr McAvoy, and on this episode of Breaking Free from Narcissistic Abuse, we're going to take a closer look at why that may be. So listen in to this week's TikTok Live about everything related to narcissistic abuse, and be sure to subscribe so you don't miss future episodes.
How are you doing with sleep? If you're a trauma survivor, chances are you're struggling with sleep too. I used to be one of those people who slept a super long time. I need nine plus hours if I could get it. These days, I think I'm operating on 6 to 7 if I'm lucky. When my husband was ill with cancer, I think I was running on 4 to 5 hours a day, and they did that for several years. That wasn't how long he was sick. It was just sort of like the outcome of all the stress and feeling like something really bad's about to happen. But boy, living with a narcissist will do that too. It puts you on high alert, which can put your body in a kind of chronic state of anxiety and tension, and it's not good. It's not good for you. So let me put on my glasses so I can read the comments. So how are you guys doing today? Let's hang out and talk about everything related to narcissistic abuse. Hey, so good to see you, Roller Coaster Love. If you guys don't follow her, you definitely need to check out her content. She has two accounts, and one of them is it's funny that it's just humorous around narcissistic abuse, and the other one's a little more serious, but awesome, awesome stuff. She's the most creative with transitions. It's really incredible. So like totally Hillary, you're stuck in that state. Yeah, I'm not as bad as I was there for a while. I literally was running on 3 to 4 hours. I'm sorry to hear that you're not the only one that's having that issue. How long have you been kind of in that state that you're talking about, the state of hyper alert? You know, our body is primed for survival. It's amazing how it will learn to keep us safe. And when you're in a threatening situation, if we were back in caveman time, how would we protect ourselves? We would protect ourselves by being alert, by staying awake, by watching through the night, by being easily startled and all those types of things. And the result, it's on alert for that. And then when we move on, but it's only meant for a temporary situation. It's meant to come happen, address the crisis, and then get over. I mean, if you're driving and you get nearly sideswiped, you move into that state. But as soon as the state jumps off, you know, it disappears, then you should like move back into the more normal state. It's called sympathetic and parasympathetic. That's what it's called in the chemistry in our brain. And so when we are in normal calm state, that's called a parasympathetic state. Our blood pressure's low, heart rate's low, digestion's happening, our skin tone is warm and dry. But when we move into these hyper alert states, digestion stops, our heart rate goes up, blood pressure goes up, salivation dries up, we become cold and clammy and sweaty, and sleep, it makes it really hard. That's why so many of us are struggling with GI problems and insomnia and all types of these issues, because this is a place in which we sort of have a lot of hard time with being, you know, in a calm state. So somebody just invited me to go live. I love to do joints, but I like to plan them. So if you guys are interested in doing that with me, please talk to me about it beforehand, so that I can set up and be aware of that. It's lingering for me too. My late husband was diagnosed with cancer in December 2014. He passed away in 2015. And then I met the narcissist in 2016, and I got out of that relationship in 2019. And I'm just now starting to sleep a little bit longer. So what have you been doing for yourself to help with that, the GI problems and the insomnia? What kinds of things have you tried? And let me pause for a moment and introduce myself to those of you who are new to my platform. I'm Dr. Carrie Kerr McAvoy. I'm a clinician, a mental health professional. I have over 20 years of private practice experience. Currently, these days, I'm a full-time content creator and writer. And I just published a book about my narcissistic abuse called Love You More, The Harrowing Tales of Lies, Sex Addiction, Double Cross. And it was published last month in February. It gives you an inside look of what actually happens in an abusive relationship, how it can happen to anyone, how crazy it feels, how subtle it is in the beginning, how we're love bombed. So you actually see the stages of love bombing, the disillusionment, and then you move into the discard, and you can see me moving through it. And then all the confusion that I was feeling, the difficulty making decisions, and all the things that people on the outside look at us and say, why are you struggling? This seems like an apparent, obvious issue. He's obviously, or she's obviously not good for you. Look what the distress they're putting you through. And instead, you know, you're in the middle of it and you're just feeling like your head is twirling and totally confused. And so that's what this book does. It gives you an inside look and to let you know, because here's the other thing is, how many of us who've gone through this feel like there's something wrong with us? Like we're stupid or we should have known better. How many of us couldn't tell what was really happening because you said it out loud, you knew how bad it would sound? And then people would want to know why you're still staying. Exactly. It was me too. So I want you to know you're not alone and there is nothing wrong with you. That this can happen to a psychologist with a PhD in clinical psychology. And I still missed it. Why? Because I don't think we talk enough about narcissistic abuse. We don't share the inside world of what it's like to be in one of these relationships. People cannot imagine the absolute crazy, conflicting, you don't even know what's real. I literally, to this day, 3 years out, and I research for this book, I still don't know what was real and what wasn't. Let me give you an example. He lost his job. He said he was laid off, but he got fired a lot. Was he laid off? And was it for the reason he said? I don't know. To this day, I probably will never know. Yeah, exactly. I can see how many of us have had a lot of experience in psychology, and yet it still happens. And until someone walks in our shoes and experiences this, it's hard to explain the utter mental confusion. It's called cognitive dissonance, by the way. Again, that's something that should happen. It should resolve. It should go away. The problem is with these states of these relationships, it never resolves. The cognitive dissonance just changes from one thing to the next. So every stage, there's a thing that you're kind of confused about. You're not for sure. Like when I first met my ex, my question I had for him was he really who he said he was? I wasn't quite for sure, but he seemed great and was really amazing. But here's how bad the cognitive dissonance was. And I bet you guys can relate. I actually hired a private investigator to do a background look into him. Here I'm falling in love, hoping to marry a guy, and I'm checking him out with a professional PI. Can you hear the craziness? That they don't go together, but it's hard to explain the fact that you're so attached, so incredibly connected to this person and you want it to be real. Yeah, you guys are asking me a lot of really great questions. So no contact is really the only solution to break. I agree with you. It is really the only solution to break through the craziness. I have to say also, in addition to that, it really helped me to write the story. To write the book it helped me to slow down what happened. Exactly. It's a trauma bond. Slow down what happened. Look at it by word and hear the inconsistencies. And then that kind of helped me like, whoa, okay, wow, I didn't catch that, but that's an apparent lie. I didn't really catch that at the time. So that really helped. I'm going to go ahead and put my glasses on because I can kind of read and kind of not read, but I don't want to miss anything. And I know somebody else had a really great question was, can they get better? Yeah, exactly. They're very good at sprinkling in bits of truth in with the lies. And they wrap it in a way that's so appealing that you want to understand. And yeah, exactly. What the question came in was, how do you go no contact when you have kids? It makes it very, very difficult. So can they change? Well, here's the thing. In fact, some of the content I've been putting out lately was from this huge seminar. Every year, there's a kind of this mental health group called Psychotherapy Networking or Networker, Psychotherapy Networker. They have a magazine, by the way. It's fascinating. you don't have to be a licensed clinician to go, and you don't have to be a licensed clinician to also sign up for it. It's getting hot in here suddenly. But so this year they brought in Dr. Durva Sola. She goes by usually on, she has a YouTube channel of almost 1 million followers. She's been even featured on television. She goes by Dr. Ramani. She's an amazing psychologist who has a lot of experience with narcissistic abuse. And So in this weekend of seminars, and she spoke twice in it. So she did about 3-4 hours of training on it. And so if you guys ever check it out, it's called Psychotherapy Networker. Does a symposium every year with the top clinicians. Every year they bring in big researchers. They come in. So she was talking about that, and she was talking about change in narcissism. And she said, can narcissists change? She said, sure. They can have maybe a little more insight, maybe slightly more sensitivity in how they say something. She goes, the problem is, as a clinician, we may go, yay, good for you. Oh, thumbs up. That's really awesome change. But for the person who's living with them, and this is what she said, for the person living with them, that makes no difference. That is not going to make them more able to show up with intimacy. That's not going to make them nicer in fights. That's not going to make them have a hard time being honest about what they're really up to and what they really want out of the relationship. That's not going to make them a whole lot better at seeing you realistically and really appreciating you and loving you unconditionally. She said, at a real life level, it's not much of a difference. She said, so I don't give partners a lot of hope. I don't, because the change are going to be incremental. Now, I know a couple self-aware narcissists, by the way, you really need to check out the How to Recognize and Overcome Narcissistic Abuse seminar coming up on April 6th at 7 p.m. Both Ben and Lee will be there. It's going to be an amazing night. It's a time that you can ask your questions of them directly. And sometimes, this is what I found, sometimes when I can't go back to the person who's injured me and I really need some answers, if I can ask somebody else who can get into their mind and help me, then maybe I'm going to have some closure. I know there's some things that mental healness, Lee has said on some of his videos, and Ben has said that is like, okay, that makes sense. Okay, now I could get that. I wish that person who hurt me had said that, but that helps. It helps to hear it from someone. Because honestly, like you guys are pointing out, a lot of this is so absolutely crazy. You cannot explain it. In a rational mind, it does not compute. It doesn't come up to 4. 2 + 2 is not coming up with 4. Come up with wild numbers like 9 and 7, and tomorrow it's 1, and it's totally confusing. So, yeah, and I'm not saying, Cassandra, I know I'm 18 messages behind. I'm not saying that doing a background check was the problem. I'm saying the fact that I went into this relationship falling in love with someone that I had such profound unease that I needed to do that. That he didn't put me at rest for me to know that I was safe, that I've not done that. I didn't do that with my late husband. I never once doubt anything he said. I'm like, yeah, that's true. Everything about his life was consistent. What was happening with this guy was he was hiding so much that it was causing a sense of, I'm not for sure how much is real here. I'm not comfortable here. That was the flag that I missed. Absolutely. Yeah, and you're right, Julie. It's hard to go no contact when you have kids. You can't. I think the word that people are now using to describe that is called limited contact. The really good book for that is, and I'm sure you've heard it on other creators have talked about it because it's just so awesome. It's BIF, Brief, Informative, Friendly, Factual. Factual or friendly? I don't know. I got the, friendly. Oh, actually, it's Brief, Informative, Friendly, and Firm. That's what the F last, I thought was factual. It's firm. What he talks about in this book, and this is the author is Bill Eddy. Bill Eddy wrote this book. What he talks about in it is how to write messages, text messages, email messages, even you could even plan it out in a conversation, how you're going to address the issue and keep on point. Because you know what they do, and you all know this because this has happened to you, is they bring in all these extraneous things. I'll give you an example from one of them was I caught my ex texting another woman. And I said, I'm not comfortable with you having a very personal, close friendship with opposite sex, particularly knowing his history of a serial cheater. So I'm not saying people can't have friends with opposite sex. I'm not saying that. I'm saying based on his history, that was not a smart idea. He said, why did you wait so long to talk to me about it? That's not the point. That wasn't what I was talking about. We're not talking about delayed communications. That's a red herring to get me off the topic. So this is why this is so helpful, is that if you keep it brief, you keep it informative, you keep it hospitable. That I don't like the word friendly. To me, that kind of bothers me. I don't think that you need to be friendly like a friend, but I do think it needs to be polite and firm. And that's what needs to. So that's what I did. I came back and I said, we're talking about having a conversation with the opposite sex and you sending photos of yourself. I'm not comfortable with that. Well, you waited. I'm talking, and that's what I did. That's how the gray rock works, by the way. Bring it back to the point. I'm talking about why you're having a conversation, and I don't want you doing that in the future. It makes me uncomfortable. And you just stay on point. Be boring, stay on point, stay firm and stay on point. But that's what you have to do. If you have kids, you have to learn how to communicate like that so that you're not hooked into these very toxic conversations that are hurtful. Can you maintain, Brody Hades wants to know, can you maintain a narcissist? I think my brother might be married to one. You know, I have tried to do that a few times where I recognize someone's, let's put this out there too, just because as a psychologist, I think it's really important for all of us to know that we're all on the spectrum. No, I'm not saying you're a narcissist, but I'm saying you probably have a few narcissistic traits. Who doesn't want to be special? Who doesn't want special treatment and feel a little entitled? When someone doesn't text you back right away, doesn't that hurt a little bit? I mean, yeah, that's a little bit of wishing to be important to that person. There's nothing wrong with being important, but you take it to the nth degree until when you begin to think the whole world revolves around you. See how I'm saying? That's a continuum. Continuum of to think nobody deserves to write you back because that's how insignificant you think you are, how invisible you feel, all the way to feel like you're entitled to a conversation the minute you put a text out. We're all on a continuum of expectations, all on a continuum of our needs. Because the root cause of narcissism, if you look at it from a developmental standpoint, from psychology, we look at each stage of life has a challenge. What goes wrong with this individual's now, do we know why it goes wrong? We don't know. It could be genetics. It could be parenting. There's even some research out there to suggest that maybe their brains look a little bit different. So we don't exactly know why some of us become narcissism. And by the way, it's on the rise. We don't know why that's exactly happening. A lot of us want to point to social media, but we're not really for sure why. But the developmental stage that seems to be impacted is the need for us to feel significant to another person. We all have that need. If you don't have that need met, if you don't have that need met, there is a failure to thrive. They've actually linked that to babies dying from infection because they feel nobody sees them or cares. We are wired to need relationships. We are wired to need to feel like somebody cares and sees us. But if that goes wrong, either an overindulgent or it's abused around that, then you walk away with this huge wound, this huge hunger for that. Now, I know somebody just recently came out and said, well, it's because of mothers. Well, I don't think that's fair. It takes two parents to raise kids. There's a lot that can go wrong. I think it's kind of, you know, mostly women get abused by narcissists because most narcissists, the statistics is 75% of narcissists are male, 25% are female. That means the majority of people affected by abuse is female because they're in a relationship with a male. And I know that I'm not trying to be patriarchal. I'm just telling you statistics. That's just exactly what, if you go out and do a survey, that's what you're going to find. But there's some reasons why I think that that happens that way. So if you look at what happens, so here you've got somebody who's wounded about feeling like they're significant, feels wounded about feeling understood. And then they proceed to try to feel that hunger by looking for it elsewhere. And we call that looking for supply. They're looking for a deep fix to this wound that is in the core of themselves that is rooted in shame. Now, that's really hard to fix because one, they're so defended against it, they're not even aware that they have it. So I realize I got way off track and I'm still looking at Brody Hades' question of can I be friends? So let's get back to that. So when you're around somebody like that, you know that you're not going to be important. You're not going to be the center of the world to that person. You know that whenever you're around them, it's going to be all about them because of that hunger is going to drive the relationship. Now, the problem with it is that whenever you threaten them, and it maybe even be accidental, like you didn't even purposefully threaten them, like maybe you got a job raise or promotion, and somehow that kicks off their insecurity and shame, then they'll do something probably passive aggressively or even directly to attack you, put you down, put you in your place, or they'll get you back later. They'll somehow like mentally note that and then make sure to even the scoreboard between the two of you because envy drives them, this feel that life is unfair. In fact, my ex said to me when we were splitting up at one point, we were talking about what he thought he was going to get out of the relationship financially, which I provided for us entirely. He said that he deserved half of whatever I had given into the relationship and I put into a business that we shared. He thought he deserved half. He did not contribute. Yeah, he worked, but we both worked. I actually worked harder. I put more hours in than he did, but he wanted half. This is what he said to me. Divorce has never been fair to me. It doesn't need to be fair to you. So you're going to see that kind of leveling that might happen to you if you have a friendship. So the long answer, that was a super long answer to you, to say, you can, but I'd be careful. I'd be very, very careful. Yeah, I agree, Hillary. They do tend to cover it up. It's very, because when you're rooted in shame, think about this. It's sort of like a self-fulfilling prophecy that they do to themselves. So I'm very scared and I don't even know that I'm scared because it's so deep inside me. There aren't even words. This happens before words. So it's in the sense of the self. It's in our body, our sensory motor self. It doesn't have words. And so they don't know that. And as a result of that, they don't have ways to describe this incredible pain. And it's pain that if they're looked at and found out, they would be rejected without words. So what do you do when you're fearful of that? Well, you get really good at hiding. You hide everywhere around everything. And the minute somebody offers you the real opportunity for real intimacy by saying, hey, we're all broken. Because that's the truth. We're all broken. We're all of us broken. We're all a mess. I love you even because of some of the brokenness. I want to offer that to you. They're like, oh, that can't be real because I know if I see it, it's bad. There's no way you're going to be good about it. You're lying because this can't be real. I don't believe you. And so they hide. So how do you break through that? See, there's a question of why we all say, well, they don't have empathy and they're not self-reflective, but that's not to the root of it. The root of it is when you're shame-based to that degree without words at such a primitive level back almost in infancy, how do you disprove that the world, that you aren't dangerous to somebody who believes unequivocally that the world is that dangerous? I don't know how. I can tell you that one of the people I worked with for years, I think I saw him like 7 years, and I was his like many therapists down the road. He'd been in therapy 20 plus years. And he was making incremental changes over 20 years of therapy, weekly therapy. He was really doing the work. And that's still how small the gains are, because it's hard to go into that kind of a place and make a difference. It's very, very hard. Yeah, it is very hard. The person that, the name of the, Julie, which name were you talking about? Because the Biff is by Bill Eddy, Eddy. And then my book is, I'm McAvoy, Carrie McAvoy. So my book is Love You More. That's the one I was kind of telling you about the details, Love You More, that just came out. One of the things that I would highly recommend, another fantastic book, it just has not gotten the love and the attention it really, really needs to have. I think it really belongs in all of our libraries, to be frank. It's Kristen Milstead's book by Why Can't I Just Leave? Why Can't I Just Leave? Her name is Kristen Milstead, M-I-L-S-T-E-A-D, Milstead, Kristen Milstead. She's a psychologist, researcher, and she's also a narcissistic survivor, and she teaches over at University of Oklahoma. She also does a lot of work with criminality and psychology. She's amazing. This book is a real look at, it happened to her, just like me, it happened to her. She's already a clinician, just like me, and she gets into this highly toxic relationship. I tell you the story in my book. What she does that's very different is she actually walks you through the stages of cognitive dissonance, which is the research right now that's happening on cognitive dissonance is explosive. But here's the frightening thing is we still don't have good answers. We know that it causes brain damage. We know that it's the biggest angst of anybody who has narcissistic abusive relationship, and we don't know what to do about it. That's the unfortunate reality. She, in this book, explains why you get stuck. She actually takes you through the mental pieces that creates this conflict, this bind that you don't know how to break. She helps you identify it, and then she explains all the research behind it to help you give an understanding. Highly, highly recommend this book. It's really amazing. It's on Amazon. Probably is elsewhere, but it is available on Amazon. And again, I really think that coming to that live webinar on April 6th at 7 o'clock, that really, it's going to be very, very helpful as well as two clinicians, myself and Manjeet, Rupai. And then also there's two life coaches. That is Kelly and Lisa Soni. And then you're also going to have two self-aware narcissists. That's Ben with Raw Motivations and Lee Hammack with Mental Healness. I think it's going to be really, really, really helpful. So Why Is Everything About You? Yeah, actually, I think I have that book, Aunt Samantha. I think it's, I've been collecting these books on narcissism, and I'm hoping to kind of work through them. That's really, really awesome. Have you guys also checked out Lundy Bancroft's work? He's amazing. Yes, yeah, Sarah. So I am very, very behind, guys. You can see that. Though they are very good at mirroring. Exactly. And that's why when somebody, there was another TikToker who was talking about counter empathy. Have you guys ever heard of the word counter empathy? That was a new word to me. I started looking at it. It has to do with social dominance, how we set up hierarchies in a group setting. And they're saying that people who tend to like prefer dominance or kind of a hierarchy relationship have time can kind of take pleasure in the pain of other people. Isn't that bizarre? And her point that she was making, and I started to do some research into it. I don't have enough that I can say a lot about it, except to say that it sounds like, and this is what I already suspected, it isn't that narcissists are unempathetic. It's that their empathy is more, they use it defensively. This is me. I'm theorizing aloud, guys. So this is not from anywhere. This is just me thinking out loud. But I think that what they do is they use it, they weaponize their empathy. Because if you view the world that dangerously, what you then are going to do is you're going to be on hyper alert for signs. You're going to use it as a way to protect yourself instead of using it as a way to connect to yourself. See, I think that's what they're doing it. They're protecting themselves, not connecting. They're very fear driven, so they're not connecting. So that's why the mirroring is so good. They can get into your head. That's called theory of mind, or cognitive empathy is the ability to mind map somebody else and understand what drives you, your motives, and to be able to get into your head like that and then mirror it back is intoxicating. It's intoxicating. And yes, they do it very, very well. They're very good at that. And they do it again defensively. This is a way to protect themselves. Oh, the birdcage one, it's called Why Can't I Just Leave? Why Can't I Just Leave? By Dr. Kristen Milstead. Fantastic book. Why Can't I Just Leave? Exactly. They do it very, very well. There are seven types, and you're going to hear this is the hard part. There's not enough research for us to consistently say what the types are, but they're sort of seems to be four general areas that people agree on of these big types. A lot of us in this platform call a covert narcissist really that what that is a vulnerable narcissist. It's not a covert narcissist, because every narcissist type has sort of a covert, meaning a hidden way that they manifest, and an overt way that they manifest. So it's really more a vulnerable narcissist. And then there's the grandiose, which is the blowhard who's at the party, who holds center stage. That's the typical one that we're more used to seeing. And then you also have your malignant narcissist and destructive. That group sort of sits between sociopaths and narcissists. They have both traits. Unfortunately, that was what my ex probably is. And then you have also the more communal narcissist, or the hero type. That's my mom, unfortunately, that type. They're, by the way, that's why when people say, well, all narcissists cheat. No, not all narcissists cheat. The hero or communal type isn't going to. They're going to be the do-gooders in your community. They're going to be people serving on your school board or on big social platforms. They're going to be at the art museum opening it. What they're doing is all about the show. They're making that's what it's not really, because they have a deep burning desire to change the world in those ways. It's a way to garner attention for themselves, but they do it through good things. They're very hard to spot. It's usually to the public, they look fantastic. It's going to be when you talk to the family that you hear the history of neglect, how much gaslighting is going on, but they have morals. You're going to find that they tend to follow through with what they say. And like I said, it's all about the image. And so why would they fuck up their image by doing something stupid like cheating? So they typically don't. So that's why to say this characterization of all narcissists lie. Well, no, they don't all lie, but are they lying? Yeah, they're lying to themselves. And then by proxy you, but not all of them go out and attempt to lie. Cause I personally can tell you that I know those who do not. I've met several of them who do not do that. So I know that I've missed a lot of... Exactly. My mom's a very nice narcissist. And actually, you would be thankful to have her as a neighbor. Honestly, she's a great neighbor. So you just don't want to be her child. So Yeah. But yeah, I married a malignant narcissist, and man, that's awful. That's awful. So are they confused? I'm going backwards. Sarah, you wanted to know, and also Spill Some wants to know, kind of you guys' questions are similar to each other. Are they aware of their behavior? And are they confused enough to know that they're part of their identity? I'm also kind of going back and making sure I'm not missing anything that you guys have said. No, I caught up. Now, interestingly enough, not all of them are aware. My mom is not aware. My mom thinks my father was a narcissist, actually is a clinician. It's kind of hard because I lived with him and I technically should not diagnose people that I know. But I think my dad is more on the borderline. My dad's passed away. But I think my dad was more on a borderline personality disorder spectrum. By the way, that's a spectrum as well, guys. You're not or are. You're on the spectrum. Again, it's a very early childhood developmental stage of, yes, not all of us have dysregulated emotions. That is a critical piece, that those who are far down the spectrum have dysregulated emotions. But all of us have fears of engulfment and fears of abandonment, and that's what they're struggling against. They have boundary issues, integrity, body, personality, self-integrity issues. They are afraid that if they show up as who they really are, you're going to abandon them. But if they then don't and are really nice, you're going to then take over and assume them and engulf them. That's the twin fears of a borderline dynamic. We're all on that continuum. Which of us don't fear abandonment, and which of us don't want to be overrun and be invisible? We all don't want that. So it's again on a continuum. We're somewhere on it. So my father was on that continuum, but he also had some sociopathic tendency. Grew up in a very toxic home himself, a very dangerous home. And he was definitely very, very careful. So, but that combination, by the way, is not an uncommon combination. I am not saying those of us who got in a narcissistic abusive relationship are borderlines. I'm not saying that. But you will see that combination of a borderline narcissist matching up. Interestingly enough, usually the borderlines are the women and the narcissist is the male. In my parents' situation, it was my father that was the borderline. My mother was the narcissist. But a lot of us, you know, a lot of us are just, the other thing that they're finding about a lot of us who get into these relationships, we score high on what's called super traits. There is a test out there called the Big Five personality. There are five traits. I don't know what all five of them are, but you want people who score high on all of them. That's the super healthy person. And it's not hard to find. If you go out there and look, put into Google the Big Five personality test and see how you guys score. But what they're finding, this came out of Sandra Brown's work, that she found that people who get into narcissistic abusive relationship tend to score very high on conscientiousness and very high on agreeableness. How that then shapes you, it means that you're a person who's easy to get along with, that you tend to go with the flow very well. You're a good team player. You're loyal. You really stand by people, and you believe in the goodness of people. You believe people at their hearts probably mean well. So you give people benefits of the doubt, and then you're long suffering because you're a person who really believes in standing by somebody. Now think about that. That's the opposite of what the narcissist is, right? Or even the sociopath. Isn't it interesting they would target people who have these qualities? The very things that if I was looking for the ideal job candidate, that was who I'd want on my team, that person. And by the way, that's also who clinicians love to have walk through their doors because they're great therapy clients. So all of us would make great therapy clients, but it makes us marks targets because that means that they're going to get into our heads a little faster and we're going to put up with it longer. Isn't that horrible? So the very thing that makes you so awesome as a person, they're weaponizing it, using it against you. So what she does in her work, and I know, like I said, we don't have any big, there is this topic with the mental health field. This is one of the places I get really angry about and I go on a rant sometimes about. The mental health field is way far behind on this topic because we tend to look at people, not relationships, as problems. We don't think about the relationship being sick. We think about the person being sick. And as a result, we just haven't been asking the right questions. So right now, she's been doing research into how to help people who get into these relationships protect these beautiful qualities of themselves so they don't become abused by other people. How for us to think about, yes, exactly, how being empathic and loyal, how to think about our empathy and loyalty to others in a way that in which we realize it needs to be valued and given away carefully, and it has to be almost, I don't want to say earned like conditional love, but it has to be warranted. We have to see, these people need to deserve us taking these kinds of risks like that. So that's, yeah, Dee Dee Delicious. I know people. I don't do counseling these days. I am a psychologist. I don't counsel these days anymore. I closed my practice when I lost my husband. I just was burnt out. But I know very good clinicians. I can point you in the direction of a couple licensed clinicians if you want to speak to somebody that I highly recommend. I also know amazing life coaches. So that's another option. So if you're interested, please get a hold of me. You can DM me over Instagram. This platform is a rough platform to try to talk to people on. I can talk to you here, but to do private messaging is nearly impossible. You're here. I really don't like this platform's messaging capacity. It's not good. But my handle is the same. It's Carrie McAvoy, PhD. You can DM me over there, and I will be happy to give you a list and send you in some directions of people. And again, I can't say enough about this seminar coming up. I think it's another great way if coaching or therapy feels out of line too much. I also know some group opportunities. Some of them are free that you can jump into and get some help. So that's another way that you can get some resources, but also the seminar is $20. If you miss it, you can then have a free replay to anybody who isn't able to make it the night of April 6th. So the links are in my bio. So if you want to contact me directly, DM me at Psychologist Carrie PhD. I'm sorry. It used to be Psychologist Carrie. Carrie McAvoy PhD over in Instagram. If you're interested about the seminar, see the link in my bio. Yeah, I know. I agree with you guys. And Sarah, I am so sorry that it resulted in you being as you put it, in a psychiatric facility. By the way, I have 2 years of experience working in a psychiatric facility. My heart goes out to anybody. It's a great thing if you need it, but on the other hand, it's not an easy situation to end up in. And then you live with it and you feel kind of like you carry the shame of that. I want to let you know there's no shame in that. Being up close and working directly with people who've been in those places and have needed that help, I totally get that. And it's helpful. I mean, it's what you need to stay safe. If you're in a place where you're not safe, that's exactly what you need to be doing. And here's the other alarming thing. For some of us, PTSD can result in some pretty significant dysfunctions, pretty debilitating mental health problems. So we're now coming to see that more clearly, that being traumatized the way that we have. And that's the thing that Dr. Ramani said this last 2 weekends ago. She said, these people, the people who are living with toxic people are They are in agony. That's her word. They are in agony. They need help. That's why we're all screaming here. There was an article that got published that I felt missed the boat. I was talking about it today with a few others who've read it. And they've kind of focused on NARC talk, why all of us are here, why there's this big interest here. And they completely missed the point that we're here because we're in agony. We're in agony. We need help. We're trying to find help between all of us, trying to help to stop this from happening, trying to find help for why we're in so much pain. It's very challenging. So caffeinatrix, I love that. You're not a dominatrix, you're caffeinatrix. That's great. But I'm glad you're able to go no contact, and it is getting better. And I'm glad, Sarah, that you don't feel shame about it, but I am horrified that you lost 10 years. That's horrible. It shouldn't have happened. I'm so sorry about that. Yeah, but you make a mean cup of coffee. Oh, man, that sounds good. How do you survive a smear campaign? Yeah. Yeah. So I didn't write about this in the book, but let me tell you how about the smear campaign of mine. And it wasn't even with people who knew me. So my ex and I found out that he was a serial cheater 2 months into the marriage on the last night of the delayed honeymoon. I got a letter from another woman. And my immediate knee jump reaction was to try to get help for him. Hey, you know, I'm a psychologist, how I think, like, let's go find, what do we do? So I take him to what I know of as the best treatment facility. It's actually not, it's a treatment program, kind of like a intensive program. And we rush out there and we have a few days in this intensive program. And then he gets into therapy and, you know, all the things that you're supposed to do, you think it's going to work. So I think he's doing the work. I don't know that he's not doing the work, but he's not doing the work. And we end up breaking up for a month. And in that month, I find massive disclosures. I find out that his cheating is way more profound than I was than ever aware of, which was devastating and horrifying. And what he was doing was he was sending around the meme to everybody he was communicating with about of a woman finding a husband outside of a strip joint and how funny that was. And then he was talking about teasing with these women individually about not wanting me to find out. Yeah, that felt really lovely. Really lovely to see that here's a man that you're living with or supposedly trying to work on things, and he's out there making fun of you for wanting him to be a monogamous, which he promised that he was. It wasn't like he came into the relationship and said, oh, I want a polyamory relationship. I don't intend to be, you know, monogamous here. He didn't say any of that. In fact, he was extremely brutal around it. It wouldn't even let me talk to men around business issues. That's how you know, double standard this, how much of a double standard there was. And it was devastating. It was devastating. So here's some advice. Anybody who believes what they're saying then is really not somebody who's in your corner. And I'm really glad we're loving on Sarah today. I am so thankful that Sarah and my path crossed. And you guys, I do get to know you guys. You know, I'm going to recognize Grammy Grinch, for example, and the mean cup of coffee. I remember your names and I remember when you guys come back here. And it's, you know, it's so wonderful that we get to know each other like this. I appreciate it. But yeah, so back to the question of the smear campaign. It's brutal. But so anyone who buys into it, I have to say that they don't know you well enough to deserve a continued relationship, and you're going to have to let them go. But those who kind of stand outside of it and don't weigh in or just stay by your side, and then, you know, those are your true friends. Unfortunately, you discover who your true friends are. The reason they're doing it, if you think about this, if you come back to the idea that they have a core of shame, their shame core, base core, what they're doing is, so they feel this, I'm going to give you inside the mind. They're not going to tell you this is what's happening, but if you look at it logically, this is what's happening. Even though they do the discard, irregardless of who does it, if you do, it's even worse. That's even more of a dangerous situation. But even if they do the discard, they know they've been a super shitty person to you. They know that. They do know that because they're not that way with everyone. So they selectively are awful to you. And so then they have to reconcile that they've left you. And there's feelings about the fact that they've left you, which taps back into that shame of, I'm a shitty person. I feel horrible. So what do they do as a defense against it? They go out and say, she did this or he did this. And this is why I had to leave. Or who would live with that? Who would want to live with that? See, you see how they're defending against this collapsing, fragile, breaking core. They come out and they smear you as a way to prop themselves back up again so that they can go forward. But they do it really well, and they do it to the right people because they're very good at that. They're very good at camouflaging and being a chameleon and presenting. You're good at getting into the mind of other people. So they do it in a way that's so powerful that people who don't know better get sucked in and believe it. That's the hard part. But what happens is if you do anything to take opposition to it, to take a stand against it, then they've set it up. They've set a trap for you. This is the problem. They've set a trap for you. The trap is whatever you say or do, they've already kind of inoculated that person that you might do that. And then you've then confirmed it by you doing it. You've confirmed they say, you know, she believes that people are after her, or they'll do something that, cause they know you, they'll predict something that you're going to do in order to protect yourself. And then when you do it, they're like, see, I told you that's what she's like, or that's what he's like. And so then you've fulfilled the prophecy they've made about you. That's why I'm saying the high road is not just simply because we're better people than that. And the truth is, you are a better person than that. But the high road also keeps you out of the bind, the trap that they've set you up for. It's a bear trap. I swear it's a bear trap. And you're going to accidentally step into it. And then it will make it worse for you. You will confirm it for them. So yeah, it is really hard. And I see a lot of this comments about time. It takes a lot of time for us to heal. And it's good. One of the things, I'm so thankful for this community, and I'm thankful that we're here together, because talking about these things, hey, we've been talking about lots, actually. We've been talking about the shame core and toxicity and why it takes so long to heal and what to do about smear campaigns and things like that. So, oh, and I see just Rebecca just joined too. It takes a long time, and it's going to be kind of your process is your process. You're going to have to sort of be patient with yourself. Do the things that you know that's going to, I'm hearing myself say this. It's so good to see you, Rebecca. I needed to hear this myself because I'm recovering from two hip surgeries and I gained like 20 pounds between the two surgeries because I've been laid up and not be able to walk much. And I'm not happy. I feel really out of control of myself and my body, and I just don't like that feeling. But it's true for this too. It's true for the narcissistic abuse. It's true for healing, of any kind of healing. It takes time. You need to do the things that you know that help you be better. So you know that being here and sharing, and oh, thank you, Ms. Mew, sharing this, knowing that you're not alone, getting into community, understanding more of what happened, making sense of what happened, speaking truth back into yourself, undoing all the poison that has happened. Did you guys see the video I put out today about imposter syndrome? Dr. Romani said that every one of us who's been in a narcissistic abuse has imposter syndrome. What that is a sense of that we're not good enough, that we are not competent enough, that we feel shaky about ourselves. They have implanted that in us. We need to reject it. It's a poison barb that's been put into our psyche. We need to reject that. It is not who you are. That is not true about you. That's that person. That person, you got a relationships problem. That's their poison. And they injected you with their poison. Let's reject it. It's not true. You are competent. You have authority. You've got credibility. You are a wonderful person. You did nothing wrong. The best parts of you was weaponized. That's evil. That's evil. So I want you to kind of like soak in this whenever you start to like feel. And for me, it's the time of the weather. Oh, thank you so much, Rebecca. For me, it's the weather. As I'm heading into summer, it's triggering me. I'm hearing my narcissist in my head. I'm hearing him say things to me, talking about my weight, talking about my age. But here's the other thing. Oh, thank you so much, Ben. Guys, Ben's here. I'm so excited. Ben's going to be in that seminar. Really, I really hope that you're there. It's going to be an amazing evening. But as we head into summer, and like I said, because of the surgery and the weight gain, by the way, he wanted me to do the surgery. He wanted me laid up, I think for a couple reasons. He wanted me laid up, I think partly because he wanted me helpless so he could go be doing more things. But it also made him feel like the good guy. But he would have commented, I know he would have made mention about my weight, that it would have bothered him. He would have had more reasons not to find me. The guy never loved me. Now that after writing the book and reading it as many times as I read it, he never loved me. Not at all. He loved what I could do for him. He liked my platform, you know, and he liked the fact that I was a writer and he didn't even know what that meant, but he could brag about it, you know. But they get into your head and it gets planted there. And lately I've been hearing it in my head. I'm hearing him more in my head. And we need to reject that. We need to reject the projections of that. Yeah. Exactly. Mine would do that too. Mine would like flirt in front of me. He would act too friendly with people. We would try to do a business deal and he'd start to send like happy Mother's Day to the real estate agent. Really? Somebody half our age and he's flirting with her around Mother's Day? Oh, actually, now that I say that, it's pathetic. Yeah, exactly. They do. That's one of the things. Anybody who takes a phone in their bathroom. Now I do that too because I just like to check my messages. But not a good thing, especially if work or, you know, it's usually a sign you're up to something and something you're not supposed to be. So I'm going to coming down to my last 10 minutes. So what else do you guys want to talk about before? Yeah, the guy that I was in the relationship with. Oh, yeah, he was intellectually inferior to me. I found out later that he had paid someone to write his papers for college. So he didn't really even... He didn't really authentically do the work. And so here I had a PhD and he paid for someone to get through college. And then, yes, he was very good looking. That's a problem. I feel sorry for all the women that cross his path. No, not everybody finds him attractive, but I found him very, very attractive. Yeah. So one of the other things that I wanted to make mention here, I do go live 3 times a week, guys. For those of you who don't know my platform very well, don't know me, I'm Dr. Karen Kerr McAvoy. I have the PhD. He barely passed college. He was having someone write his papers. No, he didn't have a PhD. But yeah, so if you, Dr. Brown's View of Shame, I think it's amazing. I do love, Brene Brown's my girl, I swear. I'd love to meet her. I really would. That's one of my fantasies, is to be able to sit and talk to her about some of these issues. It would be incredible. I'm in Texas. She comes here where I am. She has a sort of a, yeah, it is how he got me, Sarah. You got it. She comes over to Austin for a summer vacation. I would love to bump into her. That would be so much fun. I think that would be amazing. But yeah, so I was, hey, Chris, so good to see you. So I wanted to let you know, I think that I'm in Austin, Janie, I'm in Austin. You know, I just went to Dallas. I'm new to the area. You know, it's funny. I moved here just before COVID and then, so I haven't gotten to really know it. Yeah, I'm in Austin. Exactly. I love. Austin's, I think, my favorite city in the whole United States. And I've lived some pretty cool places. And I lived in San Francisco for a while. That's where I got my degree. And been in Chicago. That's where I got my college education, was south of Chicago. I've been to New York City, which is really incredible. But I have to say, Austin is something special about Austin. It's really it's beautiful and something really unique about it. But narcissistic abuse is purposefully isolating. Those who are abusing us don't want us to connect. They don't want us reaching out, because then we get more reality. We get an outsider's view. We normalize what's good behavior, and we discover what's dysfunctional behavior. For us to come together and know that we have each other, that we have lived, we have survived a nightmare. We have survived a living nightmare, is so amazing and so wonderful. And that's the power of this platform. That's the power of our connections and our relationships. I am so thankful for every single one of you. So thankful for you guys. I cannot tell you the number of people I have tried to help get them to see what's going on, and they just don't get it. They cannot get what we've went through. So that's my hope. And yeah, I would love to see California added to it. I used to live in California, so I know San Francisco Bay Area pretty well, because that's the area I was living in. So I think it would be cool, but it doesn't have to be there. Could be elsewhere. So, but it would be cool to do that. San Francisco is awfully expensive, but so is LA. Maybe Sacramento would be less so. But yeah, I do wish I'd known. You know, honestly, if this community existed 6 years ago, if I could have found you guys then, I know I wouldn't have married the guy. I know I would have bumped out. I go live 3 times a week. I always put my schedule in. Yeah, Sacramento might be a good area. I always put my schedule in the profile of my profile. So you see, it says the week of, and then I list it when and what time. And always be aware that what time I'm giving is roughly in that hour. It's not always like strictly at noon. But you guys can, that way you have predictability and you know when you're going to see me show up. Hey guys, today was so wonderful. It's always wonderful. I'll be here on Saturday again at noon hour. And, if you guys have, please DM me, Delicious. Let's talk. Sarah, I love that you're here and you're sharing, you're finding so much support. All of you who are new to me, Grammy and Caffeine Tricks, you know, all of you, the new people, thank you for following me. Thank you for all of this. Thank you for the likes. Thank you for sharing this. Thank you for just all of you. You guys, I want you to know I see you. I see you.